You're listening to WRIR 97.3 LP FM, Richmond Independent Radio. And this is the inaugural edition of RVA Report, WRIR's weekly current affairs talk show, where community thought and political leaders gather to weigh in on the headlines, their significance, and where they might take us tomorrow. But first, the news.
A few dozen protesters lined the sidewalk last Friday, July 12th, at the Firehouse Theater Project's opening of the musical Pop, urging theatergoers to boycott the show. The practice of the Firehouse Theater Vigil is being carried over from 2012's ousting of Firehouse co-founder and veteran artistic director Carol Pearsall. Local actor Joe Insko says,
"We started doing these vigils to sort of celebrate what we had lost. And in a way to protest what the manner in which it had been done."
The Firehouse's executive management allegedly surprised the board with a vote on a plan to minimize Pearsall's role for a season. One protester said, quote, "to turn her into a lame duck and then phase her out into early retirement." After this measure passed the board, Pearsall resigned in protest, galvanizing Richmond's artistic community in the process. Protesters said that they were there to show solidarity with and to represent the steadfastness of Pearsall supporters, even as the Firehouse's new season is out of the gate as though nothing had happened, and to demonstrate non-reconciliation with the Firehouse's current executive committee on behalf of Richmond's artistic community. Friday's vigil included directors, staff, donors, patrons, and actors formerly affiliated with the successful nonprofit theater who were alienated by the, quote, "management takeover of this enterprise last December." Dennis Lieberman, a former patron, said that, in corporate jargon, quote, "this was a sort of unilateral hostile takeover." And James Vigeant, one of the three Firehouse board members who followed Pearsall's lead by resigning in protest, claimed that the logistics of the vote were corrupt. And they say that this corruption, duly revealed in 2012, is still present, despite much sweeping under the rug. Lieberman said that, since so many months have passed after the original impetus, the goals of the boycott and the gesture that is these vigils have been reconsidered.
"The original specific goal of this was to get the board to resign to get them to reinstate Carol. It looks like they're not going to resign, and they obviously have not reinstated Carol. So the goal, I think, has been to do two things, which is to kind of lean on their pocketbook, and to do that through making sure that funding sources are totally aware of what they did and how they did it. And that's been already reflected in some of the grants they did not get this year. And then the other one would be to get the theater-going public to actually stop coming until they either restored Carol or resign. So that's basically what it would be. And if that closed the theater, then that would be on them, not us, because nobody wants this theater to close. Nobody does, but it's no longer what it was, and what was done needs to be rectified."
Vigeant and several other attendees echoed the sentiment, saying that integrity is essential for the arts and that Richmond's thespian community will persist in their denunciation of the Firehouse's current executive committee.
"And we don't have any intention of going away. So for as long as this theater will operate under that management, this group will be here and it will only get bigger. In fact, we have signed a petition of over 500 people who have committed to never associating with this theater again until this executive committee and this board gets reconstituted."
Brittany Tracy, Richmond Public Media.
In our city, there's a thousand things I want to say to you. Who are you? Where did you come from? Chances are your story is unique, but chances are your story isn't so different from many others. Fox RVA, a partnership between Richmond Public Media and the Virginia Center for Latin American Arts, wants you to share your story. And to help answer, are any of us so very different?
My name is Lillian Ramirez. So when I was about 14, 15, there is a lot of civil war in Colombia and a lot of violence. So my mom decided to send me here when I was 15 because she was scared, you know, something happening to me. So I came when I was 15 and I started living with my aunt. It's been good. Overall, it's been good. It's just, you know, difficult sometimes. Mm-hmm. Because of the language barrier and the culture, the mm-hmm. food. Mm-hmm. Even though there is a lot of Hispanic supermarket and Hispanic people, it's still hard to find some food that, you know, that you get back in Colombia. But besides that, it's been... Yes, when I came in November 2000, and there was only one Colombian person in my school. Oh, nice. She was the one who showed me around. But besides that, I didn't know any other Colombians. And there were some Latinos, but not too many. But now you find them everywhere, really. Mm-hmm. I guess my college experience, because when I was in high school, I didn't have legal status to go into school, mm-hmm. in college. Mm-hmm. So when I graduated high school, I wasn't expected that I was going to go to college. And then that's when my mom decided to come. She actually applied for political asylum because of the stuff that was going on in Colombia. Right now, we started a small business with my husband. We sell eco-friendly jewelry.
My name is Luciana Banbury. My family is from Panama, from the interior of Panama. My mother was from the province called Santiago, and my father was from the province called Los Santos. And we moved to the city. And then when I was in the city, I met a American soldier, and we got married when I was 19 years old, and we moved to the United States. And we traveled all over, and eventually I find myself in Virginia, but only now I'm by myself because we got divorced. And I've been working in Virginia for the last 20 years, and I decided to open a food truck, and that's where I am now. My sister lived in Virginia. After my divorce, I decided to move to Virginia. Mm-hmm. My ex-husband was from Oregon, and while he was in the military, we used to live in Texas, we live in California. We went to Germany, we lived there for 3 years. And then after we got a divorce, and then I decided to move here to Virginia because my only family in the United States live here. Mm-hmm.
Leslie Crow, my grandfather's grandmother, I believe her father, it was either her father or her great-grandfather, was actually an AWOL Hessian soldier. Wow. During the Revolutionary War.
Wow.
And that's how my grandfather's mother's side of the family came to be here.
Okay.
Maria Dodge. The first night I came to U.S., it was snow. I went to Cleveland, Ohio, and I had a miniskirt on. And it was so cold. They opened the door in a plane, and I went back inside, and I go, I'm not going over there, but I had to come out anyways. Then I didn't like it at all, and I said, why everybody wants to come to U.S. when it's messy? You know, you walk and your snow comes to half of your leg.
Okay, my name is Curly Mae Williams. Yes, well, my family is from Jamaica. My dad's side is from St. Elizabeth. My mom is from Clarendon. And they both was immigrants in England. So I still have siblings over there, uncles as well, and my mom and dad came back to Jamaica, and I went to London, then I came back and come to the state. Well, I got four boys, and my oldest wanted to be an international pilot. So when he came here and finished high school, he went to do accountants, and he was working upstate in the hospital. Then he come back to the Virginia and said he's going to the Marines. He joined the Marines, where he was a sharpshooter. And now he's at the Pentagon. He moved from the Pentagon to the federal government now.
Wow.
Yes.
You must be very proud.
Yes, I am, and I have two doing electrical work, and I have one pass away 2 years ago, alcohol poisoning. Yes, and it's still riding me.
Yeah.
I was working at petrol for a long time, and then I moved to the city, which was better than the county up in Caroline County.
Okay.
And I was living with my four kids there in Huntington for a long time, 9 years. And I told myself I'm going to move in my own house, which I did. My son graduated, and all of them, one still going to school. And I was working at Colonial Down, and I leave that, went to the Holiday Inn. From the Holiday Inn downtown to James Center at the Bull and Bear, that was a private place down there for 5 years. I'm still working and doing good things.
That's awesome.
Yes, and I do go to church and help others the best I can.
That's awesome. In our city, there's a thousand things I want to say to you. But whenever I approach you, you make me look a fool. Any progress on the city's plan for Monroe Park will follow closely on the closing of the Conrad Center, Freedom House's feeding program, and a keystone of outreach to Richmond's homeless. Maureen Neal, Chief Operating Officer for Advancement at the Daily Planet, says that her organization would set up a medical clinic during mealtime at the Conrad Center and so provide services to many individuals at once. As the issue of funding and implementing Monroe Park's renovation plan resurfaces, Open Source reports on the ways in which Monroe Park serves as a resource for Richmond's poor. In addition to community, neighborhood, and Virginia Commonwealth University events, Monroe Park hosts service organizations, including several local churches and Food Not Bombs, a program with regional chapters across the United States. Here in Richmond, Food Not Bombs is facilitated by Mo Karn of the Wingnut Anarchist Collective.
We serve a free vegetarian meal to anybody who wants to come eat food and share in the park and have access to like fruits and vegetables and the sorts of things that are difficult for people to get access to in general financially, and also are the sorts of things that aren't really served in other free food settings. In January of 2014, we'll have been doing Food Not Bombs for 20 years in Monroe Park, and in that 20 years, we've only missed 2 Sundays ever. I have literally never seen any other group in Richmond serve free food that was vegetarian. Food Not Bombs will never be shuttered, and Monroe Park will never be shuttered. We're not going to let that happen. We organized in 2010 and 2011 against it, and if they're seriously making moves towards doing that again now, then they better be ready for resistance.
Still, the Daily Planet's Maureen Neal says that other organizations could increase their level of service to cinch the loss of Monroe Park, or they might not have to, that Monroe Park draws people seeking resources, and that if they knew to seek elsewhere, they would.
Morning and evening meals are now being served at the Salvation Army downtown, and there is a network of faith-based organizations, churches, congregations in the downtown area that take turns in serving people who are homeless and or hungry. So the churches offer a lunch meal. So I know that there are opportunities for people to access food, and it prepared in a kitchen that is inspected, that is approved for food preparation. So that's one of the things that we, as a healthcare provider, are concerned about. Food prepared by anyone that is offered to anyone that is not in a regulated or inspected environment. There are health concerns with that.
But Karn says that Food Not Bombs only serves vegan meals, no meat, seafood, or dairy, and that no one has ever gotten sick.
There are opportunities for people to be fed in approved kitchens.
Which begs the question, is this really about the park? For Mo Karn of the Wingnut Anarchist Collective, it is.
Well, a public park is a space anyone from any class background can use. Anybody can come to a public park and have a picnic. Public parks are one of the few communal spaces we have that aren't limited by your beliefs, is not limited by your finances. Most places that are social areas have some sort of a financial cost. People can't go into a restaurant or a club if they don't have money to buy some food or pay the cover. People can't go into a bar if they're in recovery and trying to stay clean. And people are probably not going to feel comfortable going into a church or a mosque or whatever if that's not their belief.
She says that outside public spaces do not exclude itinerant people who often have several bags that they are not allowed to bring into regulated institutions, even those that proffer food, medical, or support services.
A lot of the other services that exist in the city of Richmond that serve free food are in buildings. And being inside of a building has some distinct advantages and some distinct disadvantages. You have more facilities, the weather won't affect you as much, but the places that serve within buildings tend to be much more highly regulated. A lot of them have cops on site, which isn't really a helpful thing to making people feel comfortable. Mm-hmm. They don't create a situation that's welcoming to anybody. Those sorts of situations are also usually explicitly marketed towards homeless people. In doing so, you're sort of creating this ghettoization of people without homes and making it so that they're not even being able to network and meet other people who just, you know, live on a fixed income or want free food or, you know, need access to fresh fruit. And it's a very sort of like stigmatizing thing to create these situations where you sort of have to like justify your houselessness to be able to get access to like a bologna sandwich and some Doritos.
Quamel Bird, a 23-year-old Richmonder who uses Monroe Park to make connections, says that it's essential for the park to stay open.
It's like a outside outreach center. People need somewhere to go where they can network and do something positive within their lives. People are reaching out to help people. People are reaching out who need help. And Monroe is that type of place where they could come and get together.
Kelly King Horn, executive director of Homeward, said that support networks do affect homelessness. They are the single biggest preventative factor. And though resources and networking are essential for people who find themselves with compromised or no access to housing, an informal social community won't be enough to solve the foundational problem.
And so homeless people aren't different from us, right? I mean, we all need support networks. So I'm not sure it has to be in a public space. I mean, for some of us, that may be how we access support, and for others, it's not. So I wouldn't say that, oh, it has to be in a park. But I would say support absolutely makes a difference. Ideally, it would be that someone's in housing and can develop their support networks organically, you know, just like anyone else. There's a strong sense of community and fellowship in Monroe Park. And again, whether people are in housing or homeless, right? I mean, it's a public space, but it's not the only public space. So I think it's really looking at, okay, how do we make sure that the needs of people are met? We're a really generous community. There are lots of ways to meet needs, I think.
What resources do the needy and Monroe Park need?
A different issue with Monroe Park is that that's how community organizations feel called maybe to help. And I think there might be other ways. How do we change our community's response to homelessness? So rather than like, oh, I've got extra sandwiches, let me go give them to homeless people. Like, wow, why are there homeless people in our community? How can we help advocate for housing resources or mental health resources? And how could we accept, you know, a neighbor who doesn't look like us into our neighborhood? Right? I mean, I think there's, as community members, it's not just about the homeless in Monroe Park. It's about what happens there and how do we help connect those services to a pathway to stability, right? You know, how do we make it possible for people to get off the streets?
Jillian Fox, Director of Programs and Evaluation at the Virginia Coalition to End Homelessness, says that the Housing First model, that is, assessing people case by case and placing individuals in permanent housing to match their needs, is an evidence solution.
You know, I mean, the solution, and, you know, in simple terms, I think the solution to homelessness is housing. That's kind of it. So how do we do that?
what we hear from people experiencing homelessness is that what they need is housing that's affordable or employment. And certainly, you know, people need life-sustaining services, you know, food and clothing and all of that. And people need human connections. Our focus has been on how do we increase access to housing. I know it's an issue. I know it's, you know, how we plan for that. How do we talk about it? How do we make sure that our public spaces are inclusive, right? All of those are issues, but the actual park, I don't think that is a barrier to getting people into housing and getting people connected.
Kelly Kinghorn agrees that Monroe Park provides Richmond's poor with valuable basic resources and that the, quote, path to stability of the housing-first approach is the effective solution to homelessness. And Mo Karn says that the city's renovation plan sidesteps both of these services by sidestepping the population who values Monroe Park.
What I see with public service projects is that when the people who use a resource are valued, then the city goes out of its way to avoid completely shutting down that resource. If Carey Street needs to be repaved, we don't shut down all of Carey Street to repave all of the lanes at once. We do it lane by lane because we value that people need that resource and that people use that resource, and we value those people.
Looking back over my false dreams that I once knew, wondering why my dreams never came true. Is it because I'm black? Somebody tell me, what can I do? Oh, Lord. Oh, something is holding me back. Is it because I'm black? Yeah.
Last Saturday's verdict in the Trayvon Martin case, finding George Zimmerman not guilty of manslaughter or any culpability for the shooting death of Martin, sparked outrage, but in some ways very little surprise. Martin was a black 17-year-old shot dead by Zimmerman while walking home from a nearby convenience store where he'd gone for candy and a drink. Zimmerman was a committed member of the neighborhood watch, who was ostensibly also guarding Martin's family home along with all the houses in their gated Florida community. Both Martin and Zimmerman, like most of us listening to this broadcast, are Americans. But the Americas each inhabits, in the case of Martin inhabited, are very different, and the verdict reached held very different meanings for those two Americas. African Americans, for the most part, reacted with unanimous condemnation of the verdict, seeing it as a further validation of communal belief that their race is seen through a different legal lens. White Americans were split. Among liberals, the response was embarrassment, a social media outpouring of apologies to African Americans. And conservative whites took to the cause of Zimmerman, holding it up as vindication of a man wrongly accused. Talk show and social media have been alight for weeks, but thankfully the predicted violence in the wake of the verdict has been limited, mostly peaceful protests. But in terms of sparking what is really needed in America, productive conversation about race and class relations and how that post-racial world that some people have touted in recent years remains in a galaxy far, far away, that conversation is going to probably have to wait. Not to say that the conversation that has occurred has not been meaningful. Nearly everyone has an emotional, visceral reaction to this verdict. But expressing the hows, the whys, and the will we evers of that conversation has never been easy. I'm with Lamont Bagby. He's Fairfield District Representative to the Henrico School Board, the Reverend Tyrone Nelson, the Verina District Representative to the Henrico Board of Supervisors, and he's also the pastor of Six Mount Zion Church, one of the city's most historic black churches, and with Charlie Dirador. He's a local pundit and businessman, and welcome, guys.
Thank you.
To this
Thanks, sir.
Very first edition of our VA Report.
Really? The first edition?
First edition.
Wow, I've never been on the first of anything.
You are the first of everything to me.
Okay, move on.
All right, guys. Today we're talking about actually a very serious issue, which of course is race. Of course, this is an issue that is in the national forefront right now, along with gun rights and gun ownership. But race sort of underlies all of this. It's the undergirding of just about every conversation that seems to be happening around this Trayvon Martin and George Zimmerman trial. Trayvon Martin, of course, having been shot by Mr. Zimmerman last week, having been found innocent.
Not guilty.
Yeah, not guilty. So here we are. Guys, I guess the question again posed today is, how do we as a community have productive conversations around this very difficult issue?
I think one of the questions that I wanted to pose, and one of the reasons that I asked these two gentlemen to join us today, Chris, is the question for me has started to become, as I've watched the news and the pundits nationally talk, is when do we win as a country? When do we heal as a country? And in healing, when? Is it when we stop talking about race, or when that conversation becomes easier? And that's one of the things I wanted to flesh out here today with these two guys.
Well, anybody? It's a tough topic.
It just appears, I mean, I listened to the Attorney General's comments. I believe it was down in
Florida. Peters. Oh, the Florida?
I think, I don't know where he was.
Okay.
But he was speaking.
Florida, Orlando.
Yeah, he was speaking to some of the challenges as it relates to having a conversation in the, under this light. And then I looked at social media, and it still seems as if it's a divide as it relates to blacks and whites for the most part. Because what I was seeing from blacks was not so much a response from it, but then I was seeing whites, mostly those that call themselves conservatives, they were bashing his comments. But what his comments was that we need to have a conversation about it so that we can move forward. And so I hear you saying,
was he on television? Was he African American or white?
Said again?
Was he African American or white?
Holder is who he's talking about.
Oh, Holder.
Yeah, Holder.
I thought you were talking about
sorry. Holder was the one that was making the presentation or having inviting the conversation.
Okay.
And then as I do with most things, and I guess a lot of people do that now in 2013, is when you're looking at TV or you're looking at the news, you also have open your Facebook or your Twitter accounts. And I'm looking at individuals bash him while he's making an invitation to let's have this conversation so that we can move forward. And
it was lighting up as you were watching.
Yeah, sure, exactly. It was. I was watching the same thing. I mean, Twitter went like that. I mean, it popped immediately.
I think the challenge is we're having the conversations, we're just not having them with each other, and we're not being honest. And I think that's the challenge nationally. I mean, you look at a trial where I'm sure, I know race played a part in it, but in the case, you couldn't use the word racial. You couldn't use the word racial profiling, the term racial profiling. But most of us who were giving our own analysis on the side, we're viewing it through the spectrum by which we live. Most of the time it's race and culture and class. And so, I think that kind of shapes the conversation. We have the conversations amongst ourselves, honestly. But then when we get with others, either we don't talk about it, we try to act like it's not a big deal, or we're not honest. There's no way to not have, it's to me, anyone that says that race doesn't matter, culture, class doesn't matter, the only way you can say that is it doesn't affect you. And that probably means that you are in a position that kind of rises above. But for those who are in positions where race, class, and culture impact you, it's a struggle and a conversation every day.
Well, now,
can I ask one question?
Well, wait a minute.
Is it a struggle every day, or is it an everyday struggle? In other words,
does a young black man
in this, and may I say black instead of African American at times? I apologize if I mix that up. But is this
where the conversation starts to break down? How do we even talk about each other?
That's a very good point.
Yeah, and one of the things, if you'll let me respond to the first part of that question, is it is a struggle every day for somebody. And for African Americans, blacks, whatever we're calling ourselves at this present point, it's for everyone. If it happens to one of them, I think what's clear, everyone sees their child in that position. And I think that's where the president's
And he comments, took flack for this.
Yeah,
for
the president's comments got mixed up is because he was saying, I was there. If I had a son, I would be having to have that conversation with my son. Reverend Nelson has a son. I can assume that he's going to have that conversation with his son. I'm going to have that conversation with my son. It's things that you need to do and you need to know before you go out into this world.
And what are those things?
It's a number of things. It's number one, and one of the things that I've thought about as I reflected is this thing has been turned on its head. Because the things that I think I had a conversation with Reverend Nelson the other day. The things that I would have told my son a year and a half ago have changed.
Hmm. How so?
Walk away. Just walk away. Run.
What would it have been a year ago?
No, that's what I would tell him a year ago. And I know you all don't want to go too far in this case.
No, I do. I want to go as far as we can go in an hour.
It appears that this young man ran. It's evident that this young man ran. He tried to get away, but he was hunted down.
According to whose perspective you see. And again, that goes back to, this is my big struggle when it comes to anything. You try to dig at the core. Only way we're going to be able to heal and move forward is to understand and respect that everybody is made different. Mm-hmm. Everybody. It's not really a black and white thing per se. I think it's more of a class piece. I think it's more of a culture, because I know some upper class African Americans who don't at all have anything in common with African Americans who are living in poverty. And so it's a class thing. But we still have to have a conversation, and we got to respect differences in each other. And I think what happens is we look at the world through our spectrum, and we want everybody else to bend toward our spectrum. And the way we live is right. And a lot of times we look at, if we're not open-minded, the only way you can have this conversation be real is to be open-minded. So if you're not open-minded, then you look at everybody else's views, and if they're different from yours, then they're wrong and you're right. And I think that's the challenge when we look. If you look at politics, if you look at daily lives, and some of the things that are important, you know, I look on social media and I hear people on social media talking about people walking around with their pants down. I just read a story where there's a council person in Ocean City trying to get some legislation passed, and about 20, 30 other places across the country, that sagging pants cause more crime. You know, so it's a
broken window.
It's
theory.
A cultural thing that I think if we don't look at the differences that come with who we are, then we're gonna always have these problems forever.
And then that's another part that I think this case here has turned us on our head, because that class piece. I think the part of Sanford that they were in resembles the community I live in.
It most certainly does. And in fact, I can attest to that, yeah. Having lived in Volusia County for a number of years.
Yeah.
That area very much is what you would find right here. It looks like in RICO or mm-hmm. like Chesterfield.
Yeah, and so I would think in my neighborhood, my son wouldn't have to deal with some of those challenges. It, you know, is a community what not many people live in. It's a really what quote unquote safe community.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think what's turned it on its head is that some people think once they get to a certain point or live in a certain neighborhood, then they're removed from those challenges. And so I think that's the part that's turned on its head.
Charlie, you have daughters, but you ostensibly could have a son at some later day.
Never again.
But, I mean, these are not issues that you have to deal with your children, but is there a corresponding...
Every parent has to deal with these issues.
Is there a corresponding race conversation that you have with your child at some point?
I've already had these conversations with my 11-year-old and my 8-year-old.
Well, what are those conversations?
Those conversations go like this. Everybody's different. Everybody's the same. Everybody in this world is different, and yet the same blood flows through everybody's veins as the same color. And so you take each person as they come to you.
But I bet you there are people out there who have that conversation as, watch out if you go into this neighborhood or that neighborhood because of...
That's the conversation my father, not my father, my mother had with me. I came up in a very interesting family. My father was not a racist. My mother was a racist. And that's very hard to say, but it's, I mean, I'm gonna, part of the reason I wanted to do this as the first show is, one, it was a lightning rod issue, and it was, two, something we could show people in Richmond. We were going to lay everything on the table in the show.
Tell us about your mom.
My mom, in 1956, 57, had the restaurant where Buddy's is now. It was called the Bel Air. And the cops walked in one day and said, you got to let her go. And she said, who? You got to let her go. Okay, why? Well, she's dating a black guy. Okay. Mom fired her right on the spot.
Wow.
Now, put that up against my father, who had a place on Hull Street about the same time, 1957. Police walked in and said, he's got to go. He said, who? I said, the guy eating lunch. You know who, Jeff. He's got to go. He said, you mean the man who comes in, orders a chicken salad sandwich and a cup of coffee, takes his hat off, says a prayer, eats his lunch, pays for his coffee, drinks his coffee, doesn't say a word to anybody, pays me directly because he knows he's not supposed to touch a white woman, pays me directly, thanks me, puts his hat back on and leaves? No, he's not leaving. You're leaving. They said, Jeff, he's got to go. I said, tell you what, he put his hands in front of him and said, take me to jail. You're not taking him to jail, and you're not going to throw him out of my restaurant. So I came up in a family where my mother saw race as, you know,
well, and I guess the question is this, is how far have we as a society advanced since that time?
Well, they say, studies show that people who were born after 1983 don't see color. Now, it depends on where you're at, depends on who raised you, but generally the studies show that people born after 1983 don't see color.
Tyrone.
I think that's been interrupted. I think that's one of the other new things that has interrupted this. Now, I think that particularly those African-American young people, the black kids, they now see color because it smacked them in the face with this case.
And then they have to begin to ask questions.
Rose glasses on for a while.
I appreciate Charlie's story. I think all of us have some hint of racism. You know, at some point we are engaged with people who have racist perspectives in our families, all of us. I think African-Americans, the same thing. You know, there are some African-Americans who have a problem with non-African-Americans. And, I mean, I don't care who they are. So, you know, I think all of us have to learn how to deal and then take and put things in perspective. And it's harder when you look at a story like this and you see, you know, which is so blatant. People say all the time, well, black people killing black people all the time. You know, I'm getting ready to go to a visual when I leave here at 6 o'clock. Young man died in Audubon Village a couple of days ago, and there's a vigil tonight. Black on black crime. It's not the same thing. And there are things that happen. This was outright a young man, you know, and according to the version, you know, unarmed, being killed by an adult who was a non-African American, you know, and George Zimmerman's Hispanic, you know, So regardless of, this now makes you have to sit down. My son says, Dad, how was he not guilty? And to be honest, I have a hard time explaining that, you know, so I have to set aside my own personal feelings, thus to try to prepare my son for a world and not have him tinged with racism as a 12-year-old, you know, to be upset with people who may devalue his life because of the color of his skin.
There you go, devalue life. Yeah. Once we, and this is a societal thing, right? Once we devalue the other human being because of their skin color, we've lost.
Or a failure to assign value, too, is the other thing. You know, something that Charlie, you and I were talking about the other afternoon was, media coverage of, for instance, if a white woman is killed, shot, whatever, the murder, just death, whatever that death be tragic that makes the news, that coverage can be for days. Mm-hmm. You'll see coverage go on and on and on. Very rarely would you ever see that in the black-on-black crime, this mm-hmm. boy that you're going to mm-hmm. the funeral for tonight. Mm-hmm. I don't know how old he was.
I'm not even sure.
Okay. Yeah. The young man or
is this the murder that took place in Jackson Ward?
Mm-mm. No, that's a whole nother. This is Audubon Village in Eastern Henrico. Okay.
And I don't think
the young man in Jackson Ward was 18, you know.
Now, see, he got a little bit of coverage, though, because he had prominent parents. Right. And so Style had a story today on him.
Oh, the Style had a story? Yeah. I know Times Dispatch had a story.
Times Dispatch had a story on this. The TV stations picked it up. But I think...
But for this...
I think, Chris, the problem is that that story happens way too often, and it's relegated to page B2, bottom fold of the Times Dispatch, and it's not on the front page.
And it doesn't get the daily coverage for days after, except for as maybe a crime story.
There's not the personalization of the story, and that's a problem.
And I guess the question that we have to ask ourselves is why. You know, it would be great to have these real, honest conversations. I'm glad we're doing this, and I hope for somebody listening, and it would encourage them. I think more so than anything, we have to really start engaging each other and having some real conversations.
And I think one of what separates this from that. Type of situation that you all are referring to is that everyone knew who the murderer was in this case.
In this case.
What the challenge is with the black-on-black crime, in my opinion, and from what I can see, is that individuals in the community aren't coming forward to be witnesses to what happened. Now, this one would have been hard if George Zimmerman would have just left the scene, or he had not called the police earlier, and it was just a young man dead. But everyone knows who the murderer was.
Killer, to clarify, since he's been found innocent, we don't want to...
Not guilty. He's not innocent. He's not...
found not guilty.
He's not guilty.
Right.
So everyone knows who the shooter was.
Right.
There you go.
But in the cases... that we kind of went and we were referring to in just a moment ago, not necessarily everyone knows, and individuals in the community, and I've seen Reverend Nelson do this lately and stepping out there and encouraging individuals that are witnesses to crime and know who's the perpetrator to actually come forth and share that information.
But there's still a victim. I mean, there's still that victim that if it's on that side. Of the community, on the African-American side of the community, you don't see the media coverage of that victim.
Let me stop you right there, because see, this is what I didn't want to get into. There are no sides to this community. Maybe I've got my rose-colored glasses on, okay?
Well, and I'm not saying there are, but I'm not painting, but that line has been painted in the past, and clearly it's painted by our media coverage.
And this is the thing. What I would want to tell my child, and what you all would want to tell your child, is that the adults in the room will be the adults in the room, and that at the end of the day, it's just as small as you telling your children, if somebody does something, you go tell somebody and let them handle it. So in this case, everyone was looking for the adults in the room to bring justice. All right. And so as the case progressed, first, white judge, everybody says, hey, it's a new day in town. We can roll with a white judge. All white attorneys on both sides. We can roll with that. All white jury. Then things are starting to look like, hold on, are there any black folks anywhere to be in these positions? I mean, anywhere. The only black person I saw was the court reporter. So those are the types of things that I think folks look at and talk about, but don't talk about... And with those individuals of other races.
And why is that important? I wanted to believe until I heard juror B37 talk that this young man actually had an opportunity to have a fair trial. This leads to the question about biases and presuppositions that I talk about all the time. The world, you cannot live in this world and not have some shade to your thought based upon something that somebody has told you. It is usually put into us as young people, and you may come out good. You may come out like Charlie, who had both and. You know, but a lot of kids don't have both and. They have one side, and they start to, as young kids, be invested in with all of this negative persona stuff that we see all the time. I'll give you a perfect example of this from adults. 2011, I live in a district and represent a district that is still about 50-50, about 55-45, 60-40, something of the nature, around 10%.
Verona District.
Yeah, Verona District. And, I mean, we're probably the most diverse district in Henrico County. First African American.
You can challenge that if you want. Fairfield's pretty good.
No, he knows that it's not. He knows it's not diverse.
Don't start a fight over that now, Chris.
Yeah. So, but I'm the first elected African American in the district, and some of the stuff that I was reading that people were saying about me was hurtful. And here I am. This was just 2 years ago. I was 37, 38 years old. I'm a grown up. I can handle it. But the stuff that I was reading about me being African American and the stigma that was put on me, you know, people had taken pictures of me while I was working the polls, you know, talking about, look at our new young thug representative. And, you know, I mean, the stuff, these are grown-ups. And so that's the scary thing, because we may have some who are mature enough to say, hey, listen, look at everybody, assign value to each person, not as a lump of people. And then you have other people who say, forget the fact that this young man is a respected leader in his community, has 2-3 degrees, and I'm still yet a thug because of the color of my skin. And so it's a communal conversation, but it has to be some individual responsibility. And if people don't want to take responsibility for their own individual actions and thoughts, we're going to continue to keep on fighting this battle, which I think is disastrous for our communities as we go forward.
Is it disastrous, though, or actually does fighting, and that goes back to the original question I posited, which is, does the conversation mean that we are still winning, or does the end of the conversation mean that we have won and we start talking about what we were talking about earlier, class, gender, that kind of thing, instead of talking about black, white, Latino, Asian, when we start talking about rich and poor, have we won the race conversation, or do we need to keep battling?
I think it's disastrous when you assign value to a group based upon the color of their skin. I think we definitely need to do rich and poor. I think we definitely need to have class conversation. If we are trying to be a tier one city with mixed income, mixed uses, particularly in the city of Richmond, and we need to start creating those communities in Henrico and in Chesterfield too. But if you start to look at the race conversation, it's going to continue to be disastrous if you assign value based upon the color of your skin.
Charlie, what's your answer to your question?
It's still open for debate, and that's why we're here. And that's why I wanted to have this conversation. I mean,
that
I'm
is
being
not
serious.
A good answer.
I'm being answer. Serious. I mean, if I don't think the conversation is going to end today, I don't think it's going to end tomorrow. I think it's going to end in 100 years. It's just sad that it's going to take 100 years.
Well, my question, too, is this. I mean, does this particular moment in time, this current event, quiz question, is this the question to try to answer this larger conversation with, or this larger question with? I mean, it seems to me that Trayvon Martin and George Zimmerman, and in particular Mr. Zimmerman, because now you've overlaid this an additional race question plus this gun question and so many other kind of layered issues on top of it. Is this really the one that should be starting this conversation for the rest of us?
Yeah. And I think, you know what I hate? I hate the fact that something else is going to happen.
Yep.
That's the part that frustrates me the most, is that something else
is going to happen.
And I just pray that everybody just braces themselves, because that if something else of this magnitude happens, then individuals will not a lot of individuals won't have as much faith in the judicial system.
You know when the conversation should have ended?
1865.
When
Well, that would have been
at St. Paul.
Time
it should have ended at St. Paul's Church in 1865, when a freed slave went to the altar to get communion, and not one member of that church would get up and go get communion, excepting for one courtly gentleman still in his uniform of the Southern Army, went up, knelt next to that freed slave, and had communion, and that was General Robert E. Lee. The conversation should have stopped right there, because he set an example that this is over with, and it's still not ended. And the question is why? And I don't mean to bring two politicians in here and blame it on politicians, but I'm going to ask this question.
I always forget I am a politician. Do
politicians, sorry guys.
I prefer the terminology elected official.
But do politicians use race to aid their ascendancies?
And that's the one thing I think, for the most part, especially in this situation, I think politicians have ran away from this. Nobody wants to talk about this. Nobody. The president of the United States had his hand smacked.
He got burned pretty good.
Referencing.
He still is on social media.
Yeah. So nobody from local government, state government, nobody wants to touch this.
And Holder as well.
Until election time.
And then
world that has been created. And then let me just say, you look at from congressional lines that are drawn to state lines that are drawn, you know, I mean, I guess was this Bobby Scott not too long ago? Looking at redistricting, trying to clump in more Democratic voters, and
we see this with almost everything. When you look at Henrico County,
even when you look at local
running buses out in the counties, this becomes an issue.
And that's the
with the charter school issue.
But you don't
for the senator. I just lost his name. Who's likely to retire here from Henry Marsh, anti-charter school, adamantly anti-charter school. And it was a white-black issue for him.
But if you think about this, you got to have the right people at the right time. So for the last 18 months, I don't look at color. I don't even care. When we get calls about patches in the roads or lawns that need to be mowed, or it doesn't make a difference what community is in Verona. I just want our citizens, when they want a response, that we are on top of it.
It's not a white and black pothole.
That's the mindset that I think we have to have. And then once you go out and you campaign, 2015, if I decide to run for reelection, my thing is I'm doing the best for the Verona district. You got what I'm saying? And so you don't have a lot of elected officials. I don't even like elected officials because they just have a negative connotation. So. But it's
people that got voted into office.
Right. Yeah. But when you start to look at it, again, it's like such a broad conversation. You could talk about it all day, but I think, again, it all goes back down to who are you as an individual at your core, and are you trying to really be – you got to look at yourself and be honest. You know, am I racist? That's the question you got to ask yourself. Do I really look at other people and value them?
All right, guys. Thank you very much. Again, I've been with Lamont Bagby. He's Fairfield District Representative to the Henrico School Board. Also, the Reverend Tyrone Nelson. He is the Verona District Representative to the Henrico Board of Supervisors, as well as pastor of Six Mount Zion Church right here in the city, one of the city's most historic. And Charlie Diridor, he's a local politician, pundit, and...
Politician?
Yeah, put it on.
I saw your name on the ballot.
And pundit. And again, thank you guys for joining.
Thank you, Chris.
Thank you.
Thank you, sir.
Like a child stealing his first piece of candy and got caught. Peeping around life's corner somewhere, I got lost. Oh, something is holding me back. I wonder, is it because I'm black? Oh. Somebody tell me, what can I do? Will I survive or will I die? Oh, keep on.
And that's RVA Report for Thursday, July 18th. Thanks for listening. I'm Chris Dovey. RVA Report is co-produced by myself, Charlie Diridor, and Brittany Tracy. The Richmond Public Media news team is Brittany Tracy, Cameron Vigliano, and Onofrio Castiglia. News keeps happening, which means there'll be plenty more to talk about next week right here on RVA Report. Join us.
Somebody, I wanna be somebody so bad. You see, I want diamond rings and things like you do, and I wanna drive Cadillac cars. Oh, I wanna be somebody so bad, but you keep on putting your foot on me, and I break away and be somebody somehow in some way. You see, I heard somebody say one time, you can make it if you try. Oh, and some of us, we're trying so hard. I want you to know that I don't speak for myself, but I speak for y'all too right now. You see, if you have white, light brown skin, or the high yellow, you're still black. So we all got to stick together right now. This I want to say to you, my sisters and my brothers. Right on, sister. Right on, brother. Dig this. If we keep on pushing, y'all. Make it a little further. All we got to do is try. And some of us, we're trying so hard. We're trying so hard to be somebody. We're trying so hard. Us back, and it stands to reason that they're doing us like that. You know what it is? I believe it's because we're black. But hey, we can't stop now. To keep on keeping on. We got to keep on keeping on. I know that you know that I know it ain't right. Oh, it ain't right. That they hold us back. They're holding us back.